Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to True Crimes Podcast. Today, I have a very interesting guest, Jen Wood. Jen Wood is a trial reporter who covers high-profile trials across the nation. With a background in criminal studies, she has been pursuing her fascination into how our criminal justice system works. She has witnessed many trials over the years, some more high-profile than others. Some of the trials that she has recently covered are James Holmes, Jody Arias, Richard Chrisman, Marissa DeVault, Stephen DeMocker, and Brian Wayne Hulsey. She has appeared on many news channels, including HLN, Nancy Grace, Jane Velez Mitchell, and Dr. Drew. She was also a news correspondent for Arizona stations and has appeared on crime shows Snapped and Discovery ID. You can follow her on Twitter at TrialDiariesJ, and visit her website at thetrialdiaries.com. And you also have a Facebook page. I have it all linked underneath the podcast of, Facebook at Trial Diaries, The Trial Diaries on Facebook. Hi, Jen.
Right.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you're very busy. How long have you been covering trials
I actually started officially covering trials by creating a blog and writing on them during the Jody Arias trial. I went there because I was a criminal justice student, and I thought, I want to go see this trial. It's one of the biggest trials happening. It's in my state. I want to go check it out. And so I ended up watching a lot of the first trial and decided I wanted to blog on it and give my spectator's point of view of the trial rather than more of a news point of view. I thought I could give a little more insight. So that's how it started.
And how did you notice the differences? I mean, what were the big, did the news just sort of miss a lot of what was going on, or they just focused on one or two things?
Right. The news would give like an overview of the case and then add maybe a paragraph of new information where I could give a lot more details, like what the jurors were doing, what the spectators were doing, what the families were doing, what, the defendant was doing. I could give more of a bird's eye view of what was going on in the courtroom, and people loved it. I was working with a partner at the time, and we were so excited. We had 35 views on our website. We were just jumping up and down celebrating. And it really took off, and we ended up having around 20,000 views a day on that website. And she ended up going her separate way. I went my separate way and broke out with the trial diaries. But it all began during the Jody Arias trial.
Yeah, that was a big one. That was a very prominent trial.
It was.
So, and actually, I want to ask you, so you do live streaming, you have a live streaming account you can sign up for. Now, do you record the trials yourself? Are you sitting with...
No, I don't record them. I'm able to link directly to the news organizations that record the trials. So my website is like a one-stop shop. You can come there, you can link right up to all the trials, you can read about the trials. There's even a place, the public can even give me their own stories about trials they've been involved in or if they've been a victim or a lawyer. I just have a section they can talk about trials too. So I always link up to what the latest trial is, and so I always have that available, and then I archive it on my website also. So if you miss the trial, you can always go to my website and watch it later.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it's a trial junkie's dream.
I see. And I read some of the things that people have written on your website, you know, that, and I'm interested, very interested in true crime, but some of these people are, I don't know, obsessed, it seems. Like, they take days off from work just to watch the verdict, and they really do.
There's a really big trial community out there that's really invested in these trials. They, you know, watch them religiously. I actually was one of, you know, I am one of those people. I didn't really watch soap operas. I was tuned into court TV. That was, you know, something I watched religiously. And it's the same group of people that are just really invested in it. And there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, the trials, do you mainly just want to do, what kind of trials do you cover? Is it only murder trials?
I cover criminal trials is what I like to cover. And I'm always looking for a good one that can, you know, capture an audience. And sometimes I've covered trials that weren't live streamed, where I've just had to purely tweet through the trial and write about the trial. And they have just as much interest as a trial that's live streamed. So you just have to pick a trial that you think will capture an audience, that everybody wants to follow along with you. And it's great. It's a great community thing that we all do together and watch. And, you know, you sit there and try to guess, you know, okay, did this defendant really do this? I'm looking at this evidence as if I were a juror. And so you try to figure out if this defendant's really guilty or not.
Mm-hmm. You can get very involved in it, and very. And do you talk to the families at all, or do you ever get to talk to any of the witnesses or anything on your own? Or?
I have developed a relationship with some of the families, and some you just don't. You're considered, you know, like a media person. The families don't want to talk to you. You know, they've got their own thing going on. But I have gotten involved with a couple families that I had a really close bond with during the Richard Chrisman trial. I got really close to the victim's family. We sat on verdict watch together for weeks. I got to know each one of them. By the end of the trial, you know, we were hugging each other, and they were just a really great family. I really enjoyed getting to know them. I wrote an article about them, what it's like to sit through verdict watch with a victim's family, just how painful that is, of the waiting and the stress of it.
Yeah, so tell us about the Richard Chrisman trial. That was an interesting one. He was a police officer who, for 10 years, he never fired a shot, and then one night he was answering a domestic violence call for a man that was high on meth, and he shot him and killed him.
Right. It was actually a really high, stressful trial. They had the police union was really involved in this trial. They had the officer that was with Richard Chrisman saying that Richard Chrisman shot this guy, you know, in cold blood. And then you have Richard Chrisman saying he was defending himself. This guy on meth was trying to attack him. So the police union basically stood behind Richard Chrisman, and the officer, the other officer, the partner, was basically being called a rat. And he had to get on the stand and testify against Richard Chrisman. And I remember, you know, Richard Chrisman had all these police officers on his side of the courtroom, and this officer that had to testify against him had maybe two. And he had threats against his life. It was just a really dangerous situation for him to speak up. And it was a really good trial. He actually wasn't found guilty of murder. He was found guilty of aggravated assault. And I believe he took a plea deal, because they were going to retry him for manslaughter. So he will be out in probably less than 7 years, maybe 3 or 4.
Wow, that must have been intense.
It was really intense.
Yeah, well, so you were there and you could actually see the people. And what was your feeling on it? Did you feel that he was guilty, or what was your take on it from watching everything?
I did feel that he was guilty of being a little trigger happy. He shot the guy's dog also, killed the guy's dog. The other officer, I really believed him. He said the guy was cooperating. And this, you know, Richard Chrisman was just a little trigger happy. But then again, you know, they did tase the victim, and it didn't really work. And it was just really, who are you going to believe, one officer or the other? Richard Chrisman got on the stand and testified on his behalf and was crying and seemed really remorseful. But he had a past of misconduct. He had actually put drugs on a homeless woman, and it was caught on videotape. And so that didn't come up in the trial, but he did have a past of misconduct. So it was hard to believe him.
Ah, I see. Okay. All right. And how about, there was another trial you covered, Marissa DeVault. She killed her husband with a hammer. And another person, last name Cook, falsely confessed to this crime.
Right. This trial actually was even more interesting than the Jodi Arias trial, and it just really didn't get enough speed in the media. But fascinating trial. I mean, it had everything. It had, you know, the defendant was a stripper. She was having affairs. There was a sugar daddy involved that was giving her up to, I can't remember how much it was, over $300,000 throughout the time they were together. And there also was a man, Cook, who had a short-term memory issue, and Marissa DeVault was trying to convince him that he had murdered her husband, and he was believing it because he has this memory issue. He confessed to it, but the evidence just did not point to him doing it. It pointed directly to Marissa DeVault, and she was just that manipulative person that she would actually try to get this roommate that was living there in the home put in prison over this.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a big trial.
Yeah,
she didn't get the death penalty. It was a death penalty case. She had her daughters actually get up on the stand, who are very young, maybe 8, I think 10, maybe 13, and then there was one that was 18. There might have been just two younger ones, and then one that was 18. They got on the stand and pled for their mother's life, and it's actually what saved her from getting death row. I had interviewed a juror after the trial, and he had said that that played a big role.
Wow, yeah.
Right.
Okay. But she's in
and
prison
we're kind of seeing
life,
that
basically.
With James Holmes. We're kind of seeing that with James Holmes now. He's had his sister testify, and we're going to be seeing the parents testify later. And when family members testify on behalf of their you know, children that are on trial, it does have an impact on a jury.
Right, because right now Holmes he's already been found guilty of murdering these people, so now it's just whether or not to go to get death or not, the death penalty.
Right.
Okay.
Right, and, you know, he has a mental illness, and you're going to have, you know, the sister was on the stand telling the jury how much she loves her brother, and she wants to see him and write to him and still be able to maintain a relationship with him in prison. So that can weigh on a juror. All it takes is one.
And I'm wondering, too, because, you know, there are all these stories going on. You were covering about how crazy he was, basically, eating cups and just doing...
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. I mean,
he was
mortified, but now
psychotic
the jury found
things.
Him not... Yeah. But they found him sane,
well,
right?
Right, because they found him sane during the crime. He had done so much planning of this crime. He, you know, all the gear he bought, well over, you know, $10,000 worth of stuff that he bought to commit this crime. The planning, he had written things down in a notebook that he had sent to one of his therapists. All the evidence pointed to he was sane during the crime. He knew right from wrong. It's the legal definition. But he does have a mental illness. It doesn't change that fact. And so the jury did everything right. He was found guilty, not by insanity. But now that we're in the penalty phase, I mean, this is a whole different ball of wax, because now he can be found to maybe not get the death penalty because of his mental illness, which these experts say caused him to commit this crime.
Mm-hmm. It's very confusing. I mean, not, you know, involved in the, you know, legal, because from an outsider point of view, it's like, well, he's sane, so he's not found innocent for reasons of insanity, but he's not going to get the death penalty because he is insane. You know, it's like, what?
Right, exactly. It's just that legal definition that the jurors had to work within, you know, when they were doing the guilt phase of the trial. But now, when you're talking about a death penalty phase, this is where the jurors can use, you know, their personal feelings and how they feel about wanting to give James Holmes a death penalty or not. And it's hard to get a group of people to all decide on that. A lot of them do when it comes to child killings. They all can seem to agree very fast. A lot of cop killings, people tend to agree and give defendants death penalty. When you're dealing with somebody very mentally ill, even though this crime was just horrendous, horrible, it gets a little harder to get all of them on board.
Interesting. Yeah, so now what do you think now today? He's at the, you're streaming it live today too, and they have his second grade teacher on. Do you think that's another, they're trying to get more sympathy for him, talking about him when he was a child and all that?
Yes, they've been dragging up their church members, family members, second grade teachers, high school teachers, elementary school teachers. And I just don't think that those people have the impact that the sister has had so far. And then we're going to hear from the parents this afternoon. Those are going to be the three people that have the chance to save James Holmes' life. You know, the elementary school people, the friends, they're all giving an account of what he was like as a child, and even some of the friends, you know, what he was like in high school. And they just really aren't giving us a good picture of who he was before he committed this crime.
Right, right. All right, I'll come back to him, but I want to go talk about another trial you covered, Stephen DeMocker. This one interested me because it said that the prosecutors landed a conviction based on circumstantial evidence, because there was no DNA, no eyewitness, no blood, no confession, and no other evidence tying him to murdering his wife.
Right.
But she was on the phone with her mother.
Yeah, very circumstantial evidence, but it really, pulling it all to Stephen DeMocker, there just really wasn't anyone else that could have committed this crime. They had enough that they definitely secured that conviction, and that was another really interesting trial. It didn't pick up a lot of speed. Coming off of Jodi Arias, that was a pretty big one for the state of Arizona. It was in Prescott, Arizona, kind of a smaller town. And they had a lot of witnesses that were testifying about Stephen DeMocker, his demeanor, you know, how he was when his wife, you know, supposedly he couldn't find her for a while. It really all pointed to him. There was no other person.
Really,
jury,
now she was
the
on the
jury
phone.
Got it right.
I was curious though, because they mentioned that he was on the phone, or she was on the phone with her mother when it happened, when she was attacked. But did her
right.
mother hear anything besides "oh no"? She said she heard her say "oh no," but that was it.
Yeah, that was it. And I believe they think that he killed her with a golf club or a baseball bat. I'm trying to remember.
Golf club, I think.
But it had, golf club, yeah. It had come from the home, and everything pointed to him. I mean, it proves that, you know, these people tried to get away with these murders, and, you know, there isn't that DNA. Like, most juries want, like, the CSI effect, but you can still get a conviction on circumstantial evidence alone if you have the right witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting. That's very interesting. Also, it was the other case. Let me pull it up here. And then I want to talk about Jodi Arias again. case was the Brian Wayne Hulsey. She was...
Yes. Good one.
Go ahead.
That was a Juan Martinez trial, also a death penalty trial. And Brian Wayne Hulsey was on meth. During a traffic stop, a police officer had stopped him during a traffic stop. The police officer had called for backup, and that was Officer Hawley, Anthony Hawley. Anthony Hawley showed up, and when they went to frisk Brian Hulsey, he pulled out a gun and shot Anthony Hawley in the head, killing him instantly. very emotional trial. It was actually one of the oldest trials at Maricopa County at the time that hadn't gone to trial. So this family, the victim's family, had to wait over 8 years to get this trial going. And it was a complicated trial. I'd have to say it's one of the most complicated to cover. I had to cover because it was a lot of bullet evidence, a lot of ballistic evidence. And I really had to, you know, get myself very familiar with guns and ballistics. It wasn't this, you know, salacious story that was easy to tell. It was very technical and complicated with bullet evidence. But great, great trial. I really liked the defendant's family, and I really liked the victim's family. They were just both a nice family. I felt really horrible for both of them. The victim's mother was emotional through most of the trial, which was very hard to watch. And Brian Wayne Holdy was a very arrogant, cocky defendant who ended up shouting at the end, you know, at the jury that they got it wrong and had an outburst. And he was instantly hauled off to prison that day. They usually wait a week and transfer a defendant to prison from jail. They actually had the bus ready for him when he was convicted of the death penalty. They bussed him right over to the prison.
Wow. so you feel like justice was done in all these cases? You agree with all the way the courts decided?
I do agree with all of them. The only one I really thought Jodi Arias would get the death penalty. I really did. I thought that from the beginning. So I was surprised, like many people, that she didn't. It was very close, 11-1. But I she was one that surprised me.
Wow, 11-1. Yeah, now speaking of cocky, she was pretty cocky during court. What were some of the surprising things you noticed during that trial experience?
During the first trial, Jodi Arias was extremely cocky. I was sitting on the spectator side during the first trial, and she would constantly look into the spectator's gallery, and she would pick somebody and stare you down. And, you know, I had my chance of just locking eyes with her, and she would just stare you down, constantly turning around, smiling into the gallery, just had a really cocky attitude the whole time. Now, during the retrial, she was a very different person. She wasn't doing any of that. She was basically looking forward. Her attorneys seemed to semi-shield her from the media, and it was just a completely different person. She wasn't even emotional at all during the retrial, where during the first trial, she cried a lot, you know, during evidence. When evidence was presented, Jodi Arias would tend to cry and wipe her nose. During the retrial, there was none of that.
Did she seem authentic with her crying, or it came across pretty fake?
I always felt Jodi Arias cried for herself. I just always felt that she was upset that she found herself in this position and was caught. She did try to get away with it. I mean, we all saw the, you know, interrogation videos, and, you know, she packed some gas cans, the premeditation of it all, of her trying to get away with the crime. But she got caught, and I think that really made her distraught, that she was busted. All her lies were being exposed for everybody to see.
And she, you know, she was pulling a lot of stunts. Like, I was just watching one of your videos where you were talking about how everybody in the court had to be emptied out for a witness to come in and walk in front of the judge or something like that. And it turned out to be Jodi Arias. Do you want to practice her walk?
Yes, this was unprecedented, and none of us could believe it, but the media and the public were kicked out of the courtroom because we were told a witness was in fear of their life, and the judge found it necessary to remove us from watching their testimony. All any of us could think of was that it had to have been an expert that maybe was afraid, such as Alice LaViolette claimed to be during the first trial. We all thought it had to be some kind of expert or maybe a witness testifying on her behalf. We couldn't figure it out. The media, we all trucked over to the higher courts, it got overturned. We got back into the courtroom only to find out, you know, it was Jody Arias that had been on the stand for a few days testifying. And the minute we all got back in there, Jody Arias refused to take the stand again. She claims that she has, you know, a fear of testifying in front of people, even though she testified for 18 days on the stand during the first trial and sparred, you know, with Juan Martinez. Now she's afraid to testify in public. She's saying that she's getting death threats, her family's getting death threats, and I think it was just more games from Jody Arias, what she does.
Wow. So, well, anything else from that trial that was very unusual from her? There's a lot of things, but...
Oh, my gosh, there's so much. I mean, this trial, it's interesting that the Jody Arias trial is now being, you know, referenced in many other trials across the nation. Judges are just on high alert of how that trial, you know, kind of went down, even as far as media coverage it's brought up. Just a lot of lawyers and judges are referencing the Jody Arias trial in their arguments and opinions on how they're running their courtroom. Jody Arias was just something else. I mean, we're talking about a defendant who is literally running a business from jail. And you just don't really hear much about that. You've got somebody selling their artwork, selling their glasses that they wore from the first trial. Just a lot of crazy stuff like that that she was able to manipulate and get away with legally while being in jail. Running websites.
Right, I heard about that she would take charge people money to call her and talk to her. There are people paying to get her advice.
Yes, and she actually took advantage of the system, which it shocks me that this was even allowed. But, I mean, we heard she was getting up to 27 video phone chats a day. I mean, something's wrong with that. She's not bored at all sitting in her cell. She was talking on the phone constantly. And they even were allowing, which is, I think, under investigation, but minors were calling Jody Arias and asking her advice. Now, you know, as a parent, how horrifying is that, that your daughters are getting advice, love advice, from Jody Arias?
God, that's pretty scary. But, you know, it sort of goes to how popular, you know, criminals have become, you know, celebrities. In a way, they get so much media attention and
right. And, you know, there was such a big movement of people that disliked Casey Anthony. Just a huge, huge, huge movement of people that disliked Casey Anthony. You didn't really see that movement of people that supported her as much as they disliked her. With Jody Arias, the support she had was almost as huge as the people that, you know, were supporting the victim's family. It was pretty equal. I mean, she had a ton of support. She's made a ton of money, and I just don't think that we'll be hearing the last from Jody Arias. Even though she's in prison, she's still getting out letters that she's wanting to be public, and she's still, you know, searching for ways to be relevant in the public.
Goodness. So now she's going to serve, what, at least 25 years or at least, or what is the exact sentencing for her?
She got natural life, and in Arizona, that means she's in till she comes out in a pine box. She's in for life. There's no parole.
Okay.
She does have an appeal going, which lists, she gets one appeal, and she's listed everything that she felt, you know, was appealable with her lawyers. And if that's denied, that's it. That's it for Jody Arias. There is no more.
So when will we know whether the appeal was denied or not? When do you think that would happen?
I really don't know. I don't know the time on this. It could take quite a while. You know, sometimes they take years. So I'm not sure on when we'll hear back from that.
Okay. Well, that does. I'll look forward to it. Now, you're covering James Holmes now, correct? You're going to be working on him. Anyone else besides him coming up?
We have a new one that started today. It's an interesting one out of Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a family, a parent that had a wedding reception at their home and supplied alcohol to minors, 18-year-old boys, girls, and one of the boys drove home and wrecked into a tree, killed himself. So the parents are actually on trial for, you know, his death and supplying alcohol to minors. So that one's on now that I have live streaming through my site. And we have quite a few coming up in the fall that I'm looking forward to covering.
Okay, great. All right, I think we've run out of time, but thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast. And
thanks for having
good
me.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.